heartily and drink a lot of beer. You should be good and happy that there's someone you can eat. A million people every day are starving in the street. Your daddy's in the gutter with the wretched and the poor. Your mama's in the kitchen with a can of Cycle 4. There's garbage in the water and poison in the sky. I guess it won't be long before we're all gonna die. Happy birthday! Happy birthday to you! Happy birthday! Happy birthday to you! Well, what's the matter, little friend? You think this party is the piss? Enjoy it while you can, we'll soon be blown to bits. The monkeys in the Pentagon are gonna cook our goose. The fingers on the button, all they need is an excuse. It doesn't take a bit of their genius to see. We'll all be crispy critters after World War III. There's nowhere you can run to, nowhere you can hide. When they drop the big one, we all get fried.
Come on, boys and girls, sing along, okay?
Happy birthday!
Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is the final straw on Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and on WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Past episodes of the show can be found on thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can easily podcast the show from radioforall.net, and feel free to contact us with ideas and comments at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week's show features four conversations. For the fourth anniversary of The Final Straw Radio, going on the air, we took it upon ourselves to have conversations with other people doing similar and different anarchist audio projects. The first non-me voice y'all will hear is that of John Zerzan. The second is Franklin Lopez. The third is a member of the Crime Think Ex-Worker Podcast Collective. And the final two are Rydra and Bellamy. Introductions will ensue momentarily. We'll be speaking this hour about their projects, about the medium of radio and podcast, about what folks have learned while doing this work, and how we feel it fits into the anarchist project towards the abolition of hierarchies, state, and capital, if not civilization. We're speaking with John Zerzan, author of numerous books and articles concerning alienation, domestication, and positing an anarcho-primitivist critique of civilization. Mr. Zerzan is also the main host of Anarchy Radio on KWVA, out of Eugene, Oregon. Thanks a lot for coming on, John.
My pleasure, man.
We're speaking with Franklin Lopez. Franklin's a member of the Media Ensemble and a producer at Submedia.tv, which brought the world NCIV just a couple of years back, as well as numerous short films from Crime Think's Join the Resistance, Fall in Love, to other short films about indigenous resistance to the Canadian state and corporations looking to further pillage the sacred lands of First Nations people in the name of industrial capitalism. Submedia TV has been producing anarchist content since 1994 and producing films since 2003. Also, Franklin's deeply involved in the production of the videocast series It's the End of the World and We Know It and I Feel Fine. Thanks a lot for having this conversation, Frankie.
Yeah, thanks for having on the show.
We're speaking with a member of the Crime Think Ex-Worker Production Collective, which is responsible for the Ex-Worker podcast and radio show available at crimethink.com/podcast. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
I'm joined by the producers of the weekly Anarchist Anti-Civ podcast airing on Berkeley Liberation Radio. The show's called Free Radical Radio. Can you all introduce yourselves?
Yeah, hey, this is Rydra here.
And Bellamy.
Thanks a lot for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Oh, we appreciate the invitation very much.
So when did Anarchy Radio begin and how?
I believe it was 2001. That's when our pirate radio station here in Eugene was busted by the feds and the local pigs. And then, I mean, they really hadn't messed with it for the, I guess it was, oh, probably 4 years it was in existence, something like that. Free Radio Cascadia, a little micro thing, you know. And I had a show called Anarchy Hour. But anyway, when it was busted and they took the transmitter, and at that point, people didn't seem to want to go on, even though you can't go to jail for that. I went over to the University of Oregon College Radio, as you said, KWVA, and they had an open slot. And I just shifted my show over there almost without a hitch, just right away. So that was, what, 13 years ago.
What would you say is the goal of Anarchy Radio?
Well, I think maybe a couple of things come to mind there. One, I think it's helpful in a kind of a solidarity sense for us to know that we're sort of connecting, even though, of course, it's a very mediated means of doing it. But, you know, I keep finding that a lot of other people come up with the same questions, the same stuff that I do, and they're not necessarily aware that there are more people thinking along these lines and, you know, grappling with stuff that, you know, you could fit it into the primitivist label if you want, but just in general, you know, I think it's helpful in that sense. And if you've been doing a show for 13 years, it's, you know, if you stick around, you sort of establish something, and there are more people that do tune in, you know, because it's a regular deal. I think we only changed the time once. It used to be at 11 o'clock Sunday night, but for quite a few years now, it's been early evening on Tuesday. So it's quite stable. And I think the bigger thing that I have in mind, just my own personal emphasis, is that if we can't somehow work toward the conversation in society, the dialogue, the discussion that breaks out of all the trivial denial-oriented stuff that we have to endure all the time from all sides, we won't get anywhere. And by the way, partly that's my beef with the anarchist scene. You know, if you want to keep talking about the Spanish Civil War or what Max Stirner said in 1840, I'm not way interested, and nobody else is either. You know, I'm interested in changing things and the practical needs of an anti-civilization thrust. And that means, to me, what I try to mainly do, this show, unlike Anarchy Hour, which is a lot about news. What is going on? What is society telling us? What is the shape of it? And how is it different from the classical anarchist view? It's remarkable to me, you know, on the same train of thought here, how few anarchists even know what's going on. They don't seem to be aware of these huge things that are going on in modernity, the acceleration of time and technology and the shootings phenomenon, even the eco-catastrophe that's unfolding. I mean, how can you supposedly be engaged in stopping this if you're not even noticing what the hell's going on? So that's I guess basically what I'm trying to do with Anarchy Radio.
Can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to start producing ITEOTWAWKIAIFF, your show, and how it started, and if there's a shorter way I should refer to it for this interview?
Yeah, you can call it the Falcon Show from now on. And I started doing it because in 2006, for a very short time, I was hired to work as a television producer for Democracy Now. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with it. And that was one of the most gratifying work experience that I've had. But due to personal reasons, I actually had to leave the show and return to Vancouver, where I was living. And I already had an idea that I wanted to do a video podcast, which back in 2005, 2006 was like, you know, the new thing was like all the rage. And when I left Democracy Now!, I felt that what they do is it's an amazing service, but I also wanted to focus on other types of news that maybe they don't cover as often, but also give it like a humorous twang, because I feel that a lot of the activist media and anarchist media and radical media that is produced and that's out there is it lacks a sense of humor. It takes itself a little bit too fucking seriously. And so I just wanted to add, you know, a bit of sarcasm and a bit of cursing and actually just basically open the space for me to yell at politicians and cops and all the people and institutions that I despise. So I created a fucking show, and you know, at the time I had a very a small apartment that I shared with my partner at the time, and I only had like a little closet where I had my computer, and you know, from that closet I started producing the show at that time twice a fucking month, and so it was a heck of a lot of work, but I was really passionate about it, and for the first couple of years, I would crank out about 24 shows a year.
And how long were each of those episodes, and how much work did it take to put out two a month?
Yeah, I was trying to do episodes for them to be like 10 minutes long. And the reason I was doing 10 minutes, one is I wanted to do something that wasn't too long, but also back then I was posting mainly to YouTube, and back then YouTube gave you a 10-minute time limit on your videos. So back then I guess my skills have developed to a certain degree, but I wasn't so concerned with how well I did the show because I was treating it as a video blog and not really as like a show, as I call it right now. And so I was able to crank out a show in about 3 days. You know, it was like three pretty hardcore days of work, but I would basically like write the script and do the interview like on the first day, and then edit the show over the next 2 days, and then put it out. But as I become a little bit more ambitious with the show, it takes me about 5 days to do a show these days. And I really, because of all the projects that I have, I'm really only capable of producing one show a month these days.
Can you talk a bit about The X Worker, how long it's been on?
Yeah, so it's funny because we're actually, you're having your anniversary right now, yeah? Your 4-year anniversary?
That's right.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're actually having our anniversary this month as well. May Day of last year was our first episode.
Birthdays! What sign does that make us?
May? I don't know. I don't know anything about astrology.
Good answer. You would not fit in Asheville.
It's deterministic. Okay, so The X Worker is an audio strike against a monotone world. No, it's a podcast, so it's aired on the internet and people can download it onto their music robots through iTunes. And the structure is that every episode we have a theme that's related to some branch of anarchist thought or history, like we did green anarchism or anti-fascism or insurrectionary anarchism. Or we'll take a concept like squatting or police and we'll try to be like, okay, how have anarchists interacted with this concept throughout history? What have different anarchists have to say about this topic? And what do we have to say about this topic, like right now in 2014? More and more, we've been doing whole episodes related to current events. We just, I think by the time this airs, the episode on the Ukraine will have just come out. And that's been difficult to pull off because of timing stuff, especially when these situations are ever changing. It's been kind of hard to line up like good coverage of something with what, like when it airs. And aside from the main content of the episodes, we also try to include news, upcoming events, and we'll also try to do an interview and a book review that's, you know, related to the topic that we're covering to sort of bring those ideas out of the realm of theory and more into the realm of like, oh, there's stuff you can read. There's like people in the world who are like engaging with these things right now. And we'll also do some listener feedback and also do entries from the Crime Think Contradictionary, which is, I think, our weird nod to having grown up watching Sesame Street. Like, this episode is brought to you by the letter A or whatever. And so that's kind of the general, that's the podcast. It's like totally jam-packed with stuff.
Can you talk a little bit about your show? What sort of format does it have and how long is it run and what sort of content do you focus on?
Yeah, sure. I can get started with that one. So it's our main focus is anti-civilization, politics and theory and conversation. And since we're in Oakland, since we've been living in Oakland for a while, our focus has also been on bringing to light and to air radical projects that are going on in Oakland and kind of a discussion of the scene here and what resistance looks like here, what it could look like, and kind of like a discourse on that, as well as topics like ecocide and technology and bigger stuff. And we go into the studio and we record for about 2 hours. So if you take out the music breaks, it usually ends up being about an hour and a half every Tuesday night from 6 to 8.
Yeah, and it ends up being, I would say, roughly a half and half mix between things that are very area specific, and that's in the past involved bringing on particular organizers or scrutinizing radical actions. A lot of it ends up, we like to dissect things and talk about what kind of political potency this or that particular act has. And then the other half is more general national, international events, and then also speaking with authors like Toby Hemingway or John Zerzan and others.
How long has the show been running so far?
We just put up our 37th episode, so 37 weeks about.
It's good. It's almost a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, we probably around like, I don't know how many interviews you've done, probably like 7 or 8 interviews at this point. So,
as someone who grew up in a time when radio was much more prevalent, a much more prevalent means for the spreading of ideas in society, can you talk about your relationship with radio during your lifetime?
I guess I wasn't very aware of it. Same with television. I mean, for example, in the 60s, I don't remember anybody who had time to watch TV unless it was, they were doing, I remember one exception to that actually in the 70s when the Symbionese Liberation Army was was functioning in the Bay Area, and I was in the Bay Area, and every night on public TV down there, they had stuff about that. But I frankly wasn't very aware of it. I have these childhood memories of these serials when I was really small, like in the 40s and 50s, before television, for Christ's sake, but that was quite different. I mean, I was just a little kid, you know, listening to The Lone Ranger or whatever it was, The Shadow or something. But I think more and more, I think that there is interest in radio.
How long did Anarchy Hour run for? And what was the prior station like?
Well, you know, it's like these pirate deals at the height of the kind of efflorescence of the anarchy thing here in Eugene. So we were moving it around quite a bit because we thought they might be more interested than not in suppressing it. I think it was 98, maybe early 98. So I did that probably 3 years. It was a different type of show back then. I don't remember it real well, but I remember more like reading stuff. Like I remember reading parts of News from Nowhere, one of my favorite books. But yeah, it was just very casual, you know, very low power. I think we had about a mile reach in Eugene, and it was a lot of fun.
What's your relationship with the podcast like? Is it a big part of your daily life outside of working on the Crime Think show? And what sort of programs do you listen to in your free time?
My free time. So yeah, like I guess I mentioned this, I'm not a very big auditory learner, so I don't actually, I mean, I do listen to podcasts. I mentioned earlier, like This American Life and like Radiolab, and I was listening to a lot of those podcasts before I started working on it. And that's when I started feeling inspired by the medium. And I think something about the thing I really like about Radiolab, and that's actually like a podcast I feel pretty inspired by, is, you know, before I was just like listening to it, and now I listen to it with this ear towards production and format. And that's like that's the difference between, you know, how I listen to podcasts now and how I used to listen to them. But with Radiolab, the way they like abstractly manipulate sound and kind of create these like landscapes that they use to convey concepts. And that does require, like, you know, we were talking about the difference between our shows and the kind of like scripted versus like non-scripted thing, like something that does require like a lot of production and like, yeah, just using like noises and sounds and stuff to convey concepts. I think it's really engaging and smart. And I'd always like to do more of that with the podcast. And I mean, granted, like, you know, shows like that have paid interns and staff, and, you know, it's just like the crazy amounts of resources. But, you know, we all have really high standards, us who work on the podcast. Yeah, so other than that, I mean, yeah, I'll sometimes put on stuff as, like, white noise, just, like, you know, NPR podcast or whatever. Oh, and I also listen to hip-hop podcasts to, like, find new music, and kind of a nerd about that. But, yeah, it's weird. I think I get a little bit burned out thinking about the radio stuff, and actually working on the ex-worker has changed my relationship to podcasts a lot, because now I can't listen to them without thinking about, like, okay, like, how are they doing this? Like, how is the show structured? Like, what kinds of production techniques are they doing? Like, all that kind of stuff. I don't know if you've had that experience in starting to do radio stuff. But
yeah, you can't just, like, passively enjoy it anymore.
yeah, you can't, like, unlearn what you know. So, yeah.
So, personally, what has been your relationships with radio in the past as consumers or as producers? Like, have you done other projects before, or did you tend to listen to either podcasts or radio shows in the past, and sort of what's influenced the way that you do this project?
I did have a sort of radio show when I was in college, but it was just music. It was basically me going on at 2 a.m. playing really weird jazz, but nothing like this. So this is a first for me, producing wise.
My experience with radio really is that I had severe insomnia as a child. So I listened to a lot of radio Like, I'd stay up all night listening to radio, and then it's kind of how I, what I do, like, when I get too tired to read when I'm up late at night. So it's kind of a way to interact when everyone else I know is sleeping. So
how has your view of the project developed over the years in terms of efficacy of spreading ideas and engaging in ideas and conversations with other folks? You've kind of talked about how you've played around recently with the idea of changing up the format of your show, but how has that looked as a progression, and what's influenced that thought pattern?
I don't know, just a general idea to try to keep an open mind about it. I mean, I guess I'm basically okay with the way it is now. My cousin, as I say, comes once a month. She was on last night, and I think it was a good show, a really good show, that in terms of, especially in terms of the calls that connected with what she was saying. Sometimes you get calls and they're good questions, but they have nothing to do with the show. You know, they're not what the topics have been on, you know, during the hour. And so it's just slightly frustrating, but it's fine. But it could be more focused, but you can't control everything either, you know, so that's the reality of it. And I think I'm just going to see how it goes, you know, and it's been fine over there. There've been a few issues, but the manager over there at KWVA has been fine. She's backed me up when there has been a little heat about this or that. I haven't had to worry about that. And Carl, who does the engineering, is just so solid, and he's just fun to be around too. But I'm not planning any big changes, but there could be. I mean, I'm not there. You know, one really flattering thing, several months ago, there were some kids that started a petition so that I would have 2 hours. And I didn't know about it for quite a while. And I said, hey, I really appreciate that, but I didn't want 2 hours. You know, I'm kind of lazy. I'll just do the 1 hour, you know. And because if nobody calls, you know, 2 hours, that's kind of a lot of work. I'd have to work more, of course, to have 2 hours ready every week. And I've never missed a show when I wasn't out of the country. I think once in 13 years I was sick. Knock wood. I mean, that's just the luck of the draw. But if you're writing, which is a solitary thing, you know, it's very unlikely that somebody would tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, you know, that last sentence, that doesn't make sense, or I think it's not true, or you know what I mean? You produce something and put it out there, and then it goes from there. But of course, radio, live radio, I really do try to urge people to call and challenge stuff. And I think I've gotten better at being more open and not getting ready to jump somebody if they don't if they don't agree with me. You know, that's the way it should be. And that's what's fun. It's certainly mediated, of course. I mean, and now it's just there are just so many ironies involved, it seems to me. For example, a few years ago, the stream was down at the radio station. And I know that, at least I'm pretty darn certain that Anarchy Radio has more of a distant audience than a local audience. I mean, it's not that there aren't people in Eugene that listen to the radio, get the radio signal, but the stream, of course, is a global thing instantaneously. And so, you know, people, or they download it later, but, you know, various countries, people in various countries. So it's just, anyway, my little story about that was, the general manager, I was saying to her, look, you know, it's not even radio anymore. That's kind of an old-fashioned word. This thing is streaming, and my show, anyway, is not so much about the radio waves. You know, it just isn't. And she kept saying, oh, you're exaggerating the stream thing. And I thought, and it suddenly hit me, here I am, the anti-tech, one of the anti-tech people, yelling at her about how it's all about the stream. You've got to fix the stream, and you're just sitting around not fixing the stream. And it was just hilarious to me, you know. But that's you're in that. So if you're streaming and people are expecting that, then that's what you're doing. You're actually boosting that mediation. You know, another contradiction to be sure, but, you know, if you sat and did nothing about the stream, well, then why do the show? You know, I mean, And that's part of the logic of it anyway. It's just kind of, we're all just part of this whole damn thing.
If only that sort of do-nothing attitude could extend to border patrols and prison guards and hopefully not people running nuclear facilities, but, you know, don't want a Homer Simpson sort of moment.
Indeed.
Can you talk about what excites you about your show and how it is working with co-hosts? You've talked about them a little bit and sort of responded to this already, but...
Oh, I guess you can see people coming up with these insights, and that's certainly exciting. Just a better way to put things. For example, this story about a month ago about this high school in New York where they canceled all the proms, all the dances, because people would rather go home and tweet and text. Big, big school. Hundreds of people show up for these proms and everything. Now nobody does. They cancel. They just withdrew the whole thing. Anyway, Kathleen Zerzan was on. This is like a month ago, I guess. And she spun that out into a whole metaphor about dancing. No more dancing. In other words, not just at this high school, but in the disembodied world that is so anti-senses and anti-face-to-face, ain't no more dancing. I mean, I can't do justice to it, but she just did a marvelous trip with that. I was just really kind of thrilled by that.
And just kind of spun it out live on the show without
exactly.
reading from a script.
She came back to it a couple, maybe 2-3 times, and it just really glowed. It was just the perfect way to capture the meaning of that. As if, I mean, it's staggering in itself. It's not, it doesn't take a lot of prying out to get it, but you know, you can do something with it if you're creative, and she certainly is. I really enjoy doing it, you know, getting in there every week. And I also have to say, Bruce, that maybe the biggest part of it is mental health. I get to get it off my chest and say whatever the hell I want, blast all and sundry if that's what I want to do. And even if I'm kind of tired, I walk out of there thinking, I'm glad I had that hour, you know, to just get behind the microphone. So there's definitely that, aside from the other considerations and perspectives.
What sustains your work on the show, which seems to be a huge endeavor to seek and synthesize video content on such a regular basis? I'm not just talking about the tacos, but I recognize the importance of those things. What keeps you going?
Honestly, it's my audience, you know, like sometimes I feel that I've reached a plateau with what I can do with the show. Sometimes I do shows where I'm just extremely bored with what I'm doing. And every so often I'll just get this one email from somebody who just thanks me and who says, like, you know, don't ever quit doing this. And so I think more than the tacos, more than the donations that people put on the website that basically pay my bills, is that it's knowing that it's having an effect. But also, like, about, you know, every third show, I'll be really inspired. You know, sometimes things click. Sometimes, like, I'm having an extremely good time working on this, and sometimes I feel like I'm the luckiest person in the world. Actually, a few weeks ago, one of my roommates, I was working from home, and one of my roommates was looking over my shoulder, and I was looking at this footage from Spain, I think it was, and my roommate was like, "You had the best job in the world." And I started laughing. And then after he left, I was like, I'm not gonna say it's the best job in the world, but I'm pretty happy with what I'm doing. It's if I hated it, I probably wouldn't be doing it. So I think that's the other thing, is that I have a total passion for this craft, you know, and not just the show, but also all the other projects that I work on are things that are very enjoyable to me, and I just couldn't imagine doing anything else.
See, as far as why I work on it, I guess I sold my soul to Crime Think. Am I not supposed to
for
say
a bag of bagels?
No, but one of the, like, last year, you know, around right before we started, one of the other people who works on just sort of made a pitch to all their friends, like, "Hey, does anyone want to do this?" And I thought it sounded like something that would be fun and crazy, and it just, like, we just started putting it together, and it all just happened super fast. It was like, I'm not working on this, and then all of a sudden it's like this huge part of my life. So,
what inspired you to create Free Radical Radio, and what inspires you to continue your work on the project, is because you're able to communicate with like-minded people? Is that kind of like, and like, further debate that you're more interested in?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of weird. I met Bellamy and it just seemed like one thing led to another. And it wouldn't make sense for us not to do it, I guess. I don't know if that sounds right, but.
I'm going to take that whole statement way out of context when I edit this.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was like, one thing less to do.
And then we just had to do it.
That too. Yeah, and as far as inspiration-wise, I mean, I think I listen to your show, Zerzan's show, and I just started listening to the Crime Think podcast.
Now for a quick musical break. What sort of suggestions would you give to folks wanting to get into the creation of radical media projects, like radio, for instance? Is the creation of new media a useful project? Or do you think that there's already a glut?
Well, do you mean radio or?
I'm thinking like, yeah, radio or podcasting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I would say just do it your own way. And I think maybe one good, easy entry point. And maybe that's the whole way you want to do it anyway, is music. Bring in music and you don't have to talk so much. And then maybe later you'll have more voices in there and want to, you know, use your own voice more, or maybe not. But I mean, that's, if you have the music, you don't have to sit there worrying about what you're going to say. And I was quite nervous about radio for quite a while. It took me years to become comfortable. And I don't want to be real comfortable, you know, I don't want to mail it in or anything, but, you know, I'm more relaxed with it now, for good or ill. But I would imagine that quite a few people, they get on the air, you know, even if you don't have to do the editing work, if you're, say, live on the air, that's kind of intimidating. So, you know, if you got music, you can do that. And then, you know, and then put in the rest of it as it comes to you, you know, and just do it your way.
DIY.
Yeah, you know. Because of course there's so many different ways to do it. That's the cool part of it. I mean, you know, snappier ways and, you know, all kinds of different approaches.
And I guess just like find what inspires you and go with it.
Yeah, yeah, that's all to the good. And keep the channels open and push the dialogue, you know, insist on something more and, you know, go for it. Just, you know, marvel at how damn crazy it's getting so fast. You know, just let it go. Just, you know, fire off. I think that's what we want to hear. It seems to me also that, of course, this varies wildly, but there could be a lot more shows. I think in some places, it's not that hard to go, especially if you're in a college town or you know, there are other possibilities. You could pursue that and have fun with it. You know, I think maybe we're starting to see that. I think there's this great thirst for, I mean, everybody knows that you get nothing from the mainstream media. It's just so absurd. It's just a parody of itself, you know, and people want more. I mean, I've seen that over the years in terms of books, that in some countries where, oh, you could never get, nobody's interested in that. They're just, you know, they just want this crap, you know. And no, that's not really true. If you find out that people have been waiting for some content, you know, and something to connect to.
Here's Franklin Lopez of Submedia.tv. What suggestions can you give to people who are looking into producing projects like The Fucking Show? And do you feel that there's room for more video and audio projects like yours or about anarchism?
Yeah, I think one advice is to understand that all these things are a lot of fucking work. And that, you know, if you're going into this thinking that this is a walk in the park in terms of like the workload, you know, get that idea out of your head. But I think that generally, like all things that are worthwhile to do are a lot of fucking work. So once you get over that idea that this is, you know, it's going to take a lot of effort, I think it gets a lot easier to take on projects like this. Also, you get better at your skill set the more you do it. And so I think a lot of people, once they discover that there's a learning curve with the equipment or with the software or with, you know, creating stuff that looks and sounds good, once people do it more and more and more, and they get better, that in itself creates the encouragement to keep on going, producing this content. Yeah, you know, understand that maybe it'll take you a few years to do it, but that this goes into your second part of the question, which is, we need you to do it. We need, not only is there more room, there's plenty of room. I mean, there's so much room that, like, sometimes I feel like I'm alone in that room. And if it wasn't for shows like your show, like Crime Things Podcast, I would feel like, what the fuck is going on? You know, I recently wrote an article for the Fifth Estate where that's my main gripe, is that we saw an explosion of anarchist media like around the year 1999 to 2001. And I really expected, you know, like the anarchist milieu to be cranking out really amazing projects, not just new shows, not just documentaries, but also narrative works and poetic works and things that just spew out beauty, you know. And when the media landscape is so saturated right now, we are competing not only with, you know, major corporations that have many resources to, you know, basically keep pushing out like this spectacle that keeps people distracted, but now we also have like oversaturation because of the internet, right? And so people who have good political minds, people who may feel that there's a void in how information is flowing about their local community, people who are just artists who might want to make things that speak about anarchist ideals in sci-fi movies, you know. Whatever, we need all of that, and we need rich, beautiful media, because, you know, let's face it, anarchists do a really good fucking job at cranking up books and zines, but on the media landscape, just look at AK Press catalog and you will find only a handful of anarchist films in there. We need to up that catalog, we need to up the radio shows, the video shows, the movies, all of that.
How do you feel about anarchists being involved in media production projects like The X Worker? What role do you see it taking in resistance in the anarchist milieu?
So I think that media production is important. I mean, like I said, with, you know, the feedback I've gotten, it's like, okay, this is clearly having an effect on people. This is like actually, you know, doing what it's supposed to do. But I also think it can't be all of what we do as anarchists. And, you know, we're in this like crazy moment in history, and there's like a ton of stuff happening in the streets and like in the world, and I think the last thing we need is to be holed up in studio producing stuff all the time. In my own life, what that looks like is I have this rule that, like, this strict policy that stuff that's going on, like, in my town or, you know, wherever I am at the time, trumps working on the podcast. And I think a few months ago, I had a deadline coming up for the show. And then there's this emergency demo got called. I don't remember even what happened. Probably like a cop had done something fucked up or something like that. And I was just like, sorry, podcast, the show's going to have to be late. Like, I have to go, you know, do what I got to do. And in, you know, projects I'm working on with friends in my town. And so I feel like for me, yeah, that keeps my relationship to it looking like I want it to, and makes me feel like that I can work on this project in a more sustainable way, and it's not running my life. Because it is like a lot of work. Like, it's an insane amount of work. I don't keep track of the hours, but if I did, you know, I think some weeks it would be like more than a full-time job. And, you know, I also work and I like do other stuff, and it's, yeah, it feels important. For me, that also, I feel like that keeps my relationship to the project like honest, because I am doing stuff out in the world. I can also bring that back in. Because I'm involved in stuff in my town and talking to people in other places who are doing stuff, it's like gonna make the podcast like less just like in a bubble of theory.
So. Your politics aren't just behind a microphone, like that sort of thing.
Yeah. Like they come from a place of like actual experience and actually like trying stuff and talking to people and being involved in like a social center in my town, or like going to demonstrations, or like, and like being there as a participant and not as a journalist. So, I mean, yeah, I also think in terms of the question again, like its place in the milieu, it's weird because in some ways there's just this saturation of documentation. You know, it's like everybody has an iPhone. I don't have an iPhone, but everyone else does. And, you know, there's like that famous, I think about that picture from the London riots all the time, where there's like the person like kicking out a plate glass window and there's like 20 photographers standing around them. And I think about, you know, like in some ways there is that saturation of like things being recorded, and it's weird that like they have to be recorded in order to like prove that they happen. That's sort of like the standard now. But I also think there's like in some ways a dearth of that material, that like raw recordings of things like video and audio and stuff like that being taken and framed in a way that does like promote that rebellion. It's not just like this sort of like passive spectacular representation of like, oh, this is what's happening, you know, you can make what you want of this. It's like you actually have to take that and be like, okay, like what do we think is going on here? Like, let's like have a conversation about this. Let's like actively engage with these things that are going on. So yeah, I have like a lot of mixed feelings about, yeah, anarchists being involved in like media production. And but I mean, again, like I think it's important.
These are Rydra and Bellamy of the Free Radical Radio Project. Do you feel that there's room for more anarchist audio or like media projects, sort of like the one that you produce? Or do you just kind of like, do you do this for the sake of, well, we've got the resources and we really want to have these conversations, like sort of a personal reason of like, I get so much out of this that I do this? Or is there the idea of like inspiring other people? Or
Ryder and I frequently remark to each other that we don't really understand how someone goes, you know, halfway or 9/10 of the way to radicalism, but then doesn't quite go all the way. Like, they still want to be some kind of civilization reformist, or still think that mass society and industry are good things. So I feel like a lot of it is, I guess I see our audience as having a potentially a range of different views. And I, you know, a lot of the show is critical. So I feel like the message we're trying to put out there is just like, look, this kind of organizing or this kind of action doesn't work. It isn't working. And things continue to get worse. And like, look, this reform is completely hollow and empty, and things continue to get worse every day. And we really have to push ourselves all the way to, green anarchist perspective and stop all of this these halfway sort of shenanigans. So I guess I do think there is a need for this kind of audio because we still have Maoists, we still have Marxists, and it's really crazy to me. And I think, it seems like these ideas have a really tenacious hold on the population in general. And I guess I see us as really trying to push that away and make people be more honest with themselves. And so, yeah, I do see a need.
Yeah, and I just don't think there's as much out there as there could be or should be. I think there's a lot of kind of traditional, like, anarchist responses, and I kind of think it's important for people to be like, actually, let's reassess if this thing that we've been doing for, 200 years is so great. You know what I mean? Like, Emma Goldman was cool and all, but, like, was that the best strategy? So.
Ice cream?
I mean, ice cream's been around for a really long time, I think, and it's around to stay as long as you keep it frozen.
Yeah. Totally.
In the show, in the fucking show, y'all deploy two characters, the stimulator and the agitator. I would imagine at some level these represent either the dual spirit of the program as reflected in their names, or also aspects of you, the producers, or you personally, I guess. Is that a correct reading? And can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even though the stimulator is, as one put it, a friend of mine put it, like the Larry Flint of riot porn, and is constantly trying to, show images that are very combative. The stimulator is actually a pretty chilled out character, and that's really mostly seen like during the interview phase of the show, where you can see that calm, collected. And doesn't really get angry. The agitator just doesn't give it a shit. The agitator just wants to see action all the time. And there's certainly a part of me that would like to see certainly like more combativeness in our movements. And sort of that's what the agitator brings to the show.
Or maybe that reflects also to a degree some parts of the listening audience and their reaction to the show. Bring on more riot porn. Where's the riot porn? Talk about Greece. Like that sort of stuff.
Well, actually, I, now that you mention it too, I mean, like that's actually how the agitator came to be, which I actually should bring it, should bring him out more often because people do enjoy his presence there or their presence there. But the agitator came about because I had just started touring with NSYV and it was going down in Egypt. And so I just kept getting these emails. It's like, are you going to talk about Egypt? Are you going to do a show about Egypt? And Egypt, 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 Egypt. And when you see the first show where the agitator was in, he kept interrupting the stimulator. Basically saying like, you got to talk about Egypt. And then finally the stimulator capitulates to this pressure, which is basically the cacophony of emails and messages that I was getting to do a fucking show about Egypt. So, I mean, Egypt obviously at that particular time deserved the show. And within the context of what I was doing with NSYV was perfect because, and this is kind of like a side note, Mubarak fell, and not even like days after Mubarak fell already, the sort of lefty progressive pacifist media was claiming his fall as a victory to nonviolence, where we had clearly seen images of combatants on the street of Mubarak's party headquarters on fire, etc.
I don't want to be complacent in my role as like a person who creates anarchist media. Like I want to constantly be challenging the role of that in people's lives and like looking to like subvert that and looking to make it like, yeah, I it's like, I don't want a world full of people who just go to work every day and listen to their anarchist podcasts on the way to work, but then just like go do their job, like that's not like an end goal. To me, it's like to bring it back around to like the thing about This American Life having like a million listeners, it's like, okay, I don't want a million people to listen to The Ex-Worker if they're just gonna, do it like, on their way to work or, doing whatever people do while they listen to This American Life, like driving in their cars, like running their Saturday errands, like I want it to like actually interact with and have an effect on what people are doing. So, yeah.
You want a million people in the streets.
I mean, yeah. Sure. 1 million people.
What are your favorite flavors of ice cream, by the way?
My partner actually makes this amazing, she home makes yogurt and then turns it into this,
Froyo?
She puts schnapps cherries in it.
Ooh.
And so it ends up being cherry schnapps yogurty ice cream. It's delicious.
That sounds really
good. Chocolate too. Dark chocolate.
Well, I guess I don't have a partner working in the kitchen to make me anything.
So
I'm just gonna go with the classic chocolate chip.
It's getting dirty in here. Oh no, my ears.
How many times have I cooked for you, Roger?
Several times.
Like every time you come over my house.
It's getting personal on the show.
Yeah.
As it usually does.
Not to sound too jargonistic, but this is a question that I've kind of been thinking about. I'd like to present you with and modify a statement by a communications theorist, Marshall McLuhan, who was writing in the 60s and 70s, and hear how you respond to it. How does the medium of radio express the message of centralization of dialogue into monologue? How is radio as a tool of pronouncement rather than an unmediated conversation between individuals, a tool that can be used to undermine authoritarian civilization?
Yeah, McLuhan, it's a very mixed bag, as you may know. I mean, he had some critiques of the medium, and it's apparently more so in his later years. But that's just part of the challenge. Once again, I think it's just another way of saying the same thing. You have a kind of technology which is anything but face to face in this world where community is just about completely gone. And you're trying to talk about that, how mass society and civilization have obliterated it. And you're using this high-powered technology to do that. You know, it's just, you could say it's a hypocrisy. But then again, if you're trying to combat it and trying to communicate, it's, you know, there it is. I mean, you know, it's, what? It's not as bad as television. You could maybe start there, or, you know, and if you're trying to keep it open and you know, have it live, I mean, you try to get around it a little bit, but all these things are mediated. You put out a book and you've got these, if you're lucky, you've got a distributor that's doing all this stuff. And, you know, the print medium is hardly some immediate form of communication either, of course. So, you know, I don't know. I think that's just part of the thing. It's, I like one of my sort of theme song tunes is New Model Army, where the refrain is, we never asked for any of this, and ditto that, you know, I mean, but this is 2014 as the techno culture deepens and leaps forward every second. So, you know, if you can sit back and say, well, that's too compromised or something, but that isn't very helpful, I don't think.
Yeah, it seems like people who are challenging, it seems like a lot of times when I hear that's like, if it's posited as an argument that it's inconsistent for you to be doing this thing because of what you believe, that seems to be positing things within this individualistic consumer choice model within the world, or like ethical purity model that people assume that we operate from, as opposed to like pragmatic with ethical considerations about what means we're using to get to a place or get something done. Like, I'm not saying that ethics is necessarily thrown out the window for everyone. I know that there are some strains of anarchism that do tend towards, or some certain thinkers that are like against ethics, but yeah, so.
I see that point very much. And I recall when my friend Dan Todd was still in Eugene. In fact, this was way back. This is the early 80s when the PC revolution started, and there were PCs before that. And we made some posters and so forth, you know, anti-tech lines, very situationist influenced as well. And what we would often hear is, well, why are you guys whining about this? If you don't want a PC, don't buy one. It's your choice. Well, I mean, is it a choice? I mean, how fast were kids required to be online in the schoolroom or you name it? I mean, it's not a choice. You'll be chained to it sooner than you think. I mean, we could have said that if we'd been if we'd had a crystal ball, but I think we even sensed back then that's not what it's about. You don't get to pick and choose. It's a totalizing thing. The technosphere is it. And you don't get to just stand outside and think, oh, I don't believe I'll, whatever it is. I mean, I didn't even want to have an email account. I didn't want to have a website. But everybody said, look, if you're a player of some kind, if you're serious, you have to do these things. You won't get any speaking gigs by writing letters. I remember Derek Jensen telling me that once. He laughed at me. We were talking about different colleges and stuff, and you know, he pointed out they won't answer a letter, and this was a long time ago. You got to email them. They don't have time to write letters. You know, what? Wake up, you know. So where's the choice? You know, you got to do that, or else you just might as well stay home and do nothing. Well, that's not quite true, of course, but, you know.
It depends on your level of how much you want to be engaged in discourse as discourse gets faster and faster and choppier. If you want to be sending text messages to someone else, like if you don't have a cell phone, that's going to reframe your whole life. If you're going to go and meet someone and they've got a cell phone and you don't, and they grew up in cell phone culture,
if
they decide to change the plans, they'll just text you or call you and assume that you're going to be next to your home phone.
I don't have a cell phone. I don't do Facebook. I don't text or tweet. But I realize right now, they're sending me these numbers. If you get to the airport, call these numbers. Well, I don't have a cell phone, you know, so I don't want to inconvenience these people, but I don't want a fucking cell phone, you know, so there again, the choice is going to be not a choice, probably sooner than later.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for talking with us, John. I really appreciated this.
Thank you, Burris. Yeah. Great to be with you again, man.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it and keep up the good work.
Awesome, and thank you, man. I really love your show. I listen to it every time you put one up, so I hope you keep it going.
Well, we've been speaking with a member of the CrimeThink Ex-Worker Production Collective, which is responsible for the Ex-Worker radio show and podcast, available at crimethink.com/podcast. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks again, Burst. This was fun.
It was really good talking to you.
Likewise. Cool.
Thanks, Burst.
All right, take care.
You too.
Okay, bye.
Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is the final straw number, so goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and on WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Past episodes of the show can be found on thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can easily podcast the show from radioforall.net, and feel free to contact us with ideas and comments at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.